This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning. We're engaged in a study period. An opportunity to appreciate our closeness to one another, really. The human organism is capable of some remarkable things. I think that's pretty obvious by now. And one way to utilize a study period or an ango or sesshin is to kind of go in search of the extraordinary. And this is a very natural human impulse. And it's also a kind of common way of looking at what we call Zen, Zen practice. The irony is, of course, that the extraordinary is the ordinary. And one way of encountering that truth is by kind of embedding ourselves more firmly in the ordinary and addressing the ordinary over and over again until it's extraordinary nature reveals itself. So that's kind of what we're doing, is we're embedding ourselves in the ordinary, and in the process of which we encounter one another in a different way. And that, of course, is one facet of the extraordinary. I'm a little sick today, I noticed. I heard that there are a number of people we know who are also sick, or have been. And this was a good opportunity, once again, for me to notice the tremendous tendency of the human being to privilege a particular point of view, namely mine. So the universe is a limitless field of dependent co-arising, and really no particular dependent co-arising is any cooler than any other, believe it or not. And yet, I notice that there are dependent co-arisings that I almost belligerently acclaim to be me, and others that I reject on the same basis. So this is the karmic habit of the sentient being. And as I say, the impulse to use an almost Buddhist word, the impulse driving that is very, very strong. And of course is based on the almost unquestioned assumption that our separateness is not merely apparent, but intrinsic. And among other things, Buddhists said that actually that's not a balanced picture. That is an unbalanced picture. And as a result, great suffering ensues. So this was a fairly drastic assessment of our human situation, and as you know, Buddha had some trouble with it too. And I guess I wasn't feeling quite up to speaking instructions during Zazen this morning, which I used to do a lot more, and now I do less for some reason. But I remembered that the Murti, the Buddha figure on our altar here, is Buddha in the Bhumisparsha mudra, the earth-touching mudra, which is what he did when he was having trouble with this whatever insight, this drastic reframing of personhood. So, as we say, he called his mom, right, and said, "Can I really do this?" And she said, "Yeah, go for it, kid." And so then the trouble he was having, which we personify as some critter called Mara, he met with this reassurance from his mom that, yeah, you can go right ahead and be drastic. And when Mara shows up, tell him, "Sorry, I can't buy what you're selling anymore." And he says this little poem about he says, I know who built the house now. And once you know that, once you know the house builder, your life is never the same. So one way to get to know the house builder is to immerse yourself in the ordinary. And that's a specialty of what's sometimes called Soto Zen. Although even what that term means, I notice, is subject to some argument. I was recently up in Oregon, you know, with a bunch of Soto Zenists, and discovered that no, not all of us agree on what Soto Zen is or means. And those of us who think we know, or anyway, I'm not necessarily, how should I say, moved by some of the arguments I hear to the contrary. I guess primarily because I was fortunate enough to encounter this immersing in the ordinary as a way of meeting the extraordinary. So right now that way is still dressed up a little bit in certain Asian fripperies and customs. But, you know, that's okay. As I've said many times, it always has to look some way or other. And the way it looks, to me, is aesthetically very appealing. Instead, we were all dressed in denim and flannel, and the furniture were all kind of, you know, arts and crafts or shaker or something. You know, that'd be interesting. That's another aesthetic. That would work too, probably. That's not quite what we inherited, so it's not looking that way right now, but in 100 years, who knows? Personally, I hope that in 100 years, something called Soto Zen, which is immersion in the ordinary, will still be around for people to benefit from. Meanwhile, I am startled over and over again with my insistence on privileging a certain subset of dependent co-arising. And I'm also startled by how in this practice of what we call just sitting, the discomfort of constantly maintaining that position vis-a-vis the universe becomes apparent. And we can actually see and begin to sense what it's like to relax from that. And to take a place on a high peak from which we can see a universe of dependent co-arising without stamping everything with our initials, or at least the stuff we like, and then banishing all the stuff we don't like. And as a result, winding up in this cramped posture called sentient being. Fortunately, as Buddha discovered, sentient beings also are awake. And therefore, the extraordinary is always at their fingertips. And speaking of drastic, of course, Suzuki Roshi was heard to say that we are always face to face with God. And I think that's pretty right on, but that's also pretty drastic. And again, subject to disagreement. So, among other things, in this study period, we have a head monk, Reverend Tanzin, who is modeling practice for us quite ably. And part of the fun is getting him to do all kinds of things that he hasn't done before. And see what happens. So today we have another busy day. It's the full moon, so we should do some sort of full moon ceremony, and then we have the Sangha Council afterwards. So we've already bitten a great big chunk out of Saturday. So I was thinking Shuso might like to be Doshi for the full moon ceremony.
You were working.
I was thinking about that. He doesn't have to. All this is optional. But this is a time when all of these opportunities first kind of appear, at least in one style. So and again, all of these the stuff we do is immersion in the ordinary, but we try to turn the ordinary just a few degrees off center so that that ability we have to sense the extraordinary is nudged just a little bit. So that's kind of why there's a particular way of doing most things rather than just any old way. It's to turn the ordinary a few degrees off its habitual straight line. And the gleams of the extraordinary that are always present can strike the eye in a way that's maybe new to us. And although that particular phenomenon doesn't have much in the way of content, you could say, it's very encouraging. The body-mind feels it. So, if at the moment you're not noticing anything extraordinary, well, that's okay. But, you know, again, try not to privilege that perception over the perception that, like, well, maybe the extraordinary is equally present. So try to relax the habit that we have of husbanding just these perceptions and not those. Watch the universe from that peak of, well, the seat of dependent co-arising that Buddha taught about. And when he noticed himself there, he was kind of freaked out. So he called his mom. And she said, all right, sit right there and see what happens. So I invite all of us again to embrace and sustain that way of living, this way of living, and let the benefit naturally accrue, and let the benefit extend to others too, as it will. So, if you would like to dispute or offer some question, yes, please.
Can you encapsulate the differences that you ran into up in Oregon?
Well,
the different points.
Well, it probably mostly has to do with this. Do you pursue the extraordinary or don't you? I would guess that's probably the main one. There are others. And there's some people who, usually not so publicly, but sometimes even then, will complain that those guys over there, they're not pursuing the extraordinary. So boo on them. And this is, you know, kind of belligerent. And surprising when it happens. Mostly it happens in private, as I said, but there's, and sometimes it gets into the air. So that was the main thing, I guess. And you can see that there's some folks who, I don't know, their immersion in the ordinary was sort of, it didn't work very well. And as a result, I wouldn't say this to them, so maybe I shouldn't say it at all. But then again, you don't know who I'm talking about, so maybe it's okay. If I say it, they kind of schlep around, and it just looks like, why is it kind of schlepping around? And sort of like, you know, where's the body of practice in this? Well, they might say, I've had a number of extraordinary experiences, and that's all that counts. It's like, okay. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to see. If they're happy, I'm happy. But then we should let everyone be happy, right? Instead of try to divide the herd, you know, something like that. Yes.
Recently, I was reading a book, Zen Ritual,
mm-hmm.
the chapter by Tekken and Layton on Zen as an enactment ritual of awakening.
Yes.
And it's interesting that in there he, I think he's quoting Dogen, or at least channeling Dogen,
mm-hmm.
Where he says that a certain decorum, I guess you'd call it, is, along with Zazen, an embodiment ritual of awakening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of what you were talking about. I mean, you don't schlup around, you know?
Yeah.
But you don't need to be sort of a fussy old queen about it either.
Right.
You know, there's kind of nice middling ground there. Perhaps.
Yeah, there is. There is. And, you know, Suzuki Roshi said, you know, new priests smell bad for about 5 years. And that's because they're so convinced that now they're not schlepping around anymore, that it shows that they think that, which is kind of a burden, right? And it takes a while for that to wear away by more immersion in the ordinary, until the home lever life is just ordinary. And that, of course, leaves room for the extraordinary to show its face. Yes.
Thank you. Forgive me for my lack of understanding, but I didn't quite understand the reference to the home builder.
Oh, the house builder.
House builder?
Yeah. Well, that was that little poem that Buddha said when he woke up, and he said, I know you, house builder. I know who you are now, meaning this, the so-called person. It was a metaphor for the so-called sentient being. He said, I know you, and no, you'll never again build these walls or that roof. So that's his little poetic framing. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
All right. Risk.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I think that it's very nice, you know, clothes and, you know, East Asian things.
Very nice.
And I do feel like there's nothing particularly special about that. And so I feel like it's always our sort of, that we should always be listening to what the request is.
Yes.
And always be ready to enact, you know, what will most, you know, lead to that.
Yeah.
Experience of intimacy or awakening or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I don't know if I'd put it quite that way, that what we're trying to do is figure out what will lead to an experience. It's more like immersion in the ordinary, as I said, is always going to look some way. And if the way that it currently looks is troublesome to a lot of people, then maybe we should be ready to switch to denim and flannel. And indeed, there is nothing particularly special about an East Asian aesthetic, except that I like it. That's about it. There are other aesthetics I like too. There's a certain kind of evolution that is good to respect, which makes the process rather slow, and attempts to speed it up that I have seen have tended to not turn out so well. They're either ugly or harsh or nuts, basically. So personally, I'm content to let things unfold as they do. And I'm already, some would say, not just pushing the envelope, but tearing it by wearing Chinese clothes. I mean, what do I think I'm doing, right? This is Japanese lineage. Why are you wearing Chinese clothes? What's the matter with you? So I get that sometimes. And I just look sheepish and scuff the floor and say, gosh, I don't know, I'm sorry. And then I just go on wearing Chinese clothes. So this evolution is happening, and it may be a couple more generations before it looks starkly different from how it looks now, but eventually it probably will. And that's okay. As long as the way we're expressing Shakyamuni Buddha's awakening is, you know, rings true somehow. And I think at the moment we're doing pretty well. Probably could do better, so let's keep at it. Let's not lose what Tsukiroshi called the spirit of repetition, which is pretty powerful and pretty important. Again, see what happens. And thank you for being one of the people taking care. Yes?
Is there an aspect to both traditions that your awakening really is yours?
Both traditions meaning aggressive pursuit of the extraordinary?
Yeah.
And not so aggressive?
Yeah.
Well, sure. Yeah, your awakening isn't anybody else's. It's not Shakyamuni's. It's not Dogen's. It's, quote, yours, unquote.
Well, yours,
but
right.
The understanding of what yours means changes rather drastically.
I think, to me, it seems that people put a lot of emphasis on you know, somebody else telling them what their awakening should be, or verifying that it happened. And I was very moved yesterday, remembering something Ed Brown says in that movie, How to Cook Your Life, where he says for years he was so annoyed with the food offerings in the Zendo Atasa, because you just take it, you do all that work and all that effort, and then you just put it on the altar, and you just leave it.
Yeah.
You just leave it on the
just
altar.
Leave it there.
He realized, oh, that's right, you just set it on the altar and you put it there.
You leave it. And if you do that once or twice, that's a certain the body-mind has a certain acquaintanceship with something, and if you do it 1,000 times, it's a little different. And if you do something 1,000 times, sometimes something that is, you know, so utterly ordinary to you that breaks open. So that's one reason why we do so many things the same way over and over and over again. That's our way of addressing the ordinary over and over and over again, so that it turns. Is there a hand back there? Yes.
Yeah, I was just thinking, from my limited experience in the in Soto Zen monastic training, but that, and it is East Asian and different, but I think about that, it seems that across monastic traditions, not just in Buddhist tradition, there is a commonality in the simplicity of like still in the Zen training, it's boiling things down to basically just your bowls and a robe.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of simplicity, I think, is very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
That it pushes away a lot of the distractions, even of choosing what you're going to wear, or
yep.
the distractions of possessions.
Yep.
And
yep.
it seems like a good ground for practicing. And I know that, again, from my limited knowledge, but I assume that Christian monks and monks in other traditions also have similar, that simplicity seems to be helpful.
Yeah. You know, sometimes there really is so much stuff that you can barely move. Right? There's just so much stuff. When I was at Christ in the Desert Monastery in New Mexico, around Passiontide before Easter, each monk goes to the abbot and they go over a list of their stuff and see, is there anything you can get rid of? They do that every year. And usually there's something you don't need, you know, you have an extra, I don't know what, ballpoint pen or something. They don't have anything, basically. And then they get rid of that, too. So there is something about the simplicity that kind of clears the air a little bit. And I find quite helpful, even though I have a lot of stuff I could probably get rid of. So
it seems like it goes way back, too, because in Buddhist time itself, that was the monks, they just had their patch robes and their bowls, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And hopefully there were some people around who thought enough of what they were doing that they would like give them food. Otherwise life could be pretty short. So I sometimes worry if, I know that I've said, if my practice isn't full-bodied and wholehearted enough, people will stop feeding me and then, you know, I'll shrivel up and die. It's like, well, all right, too bad for you. Anyway, here it is, going on 11, and we have some more stuff to do, some more ordinariness to immerse ourselves in, even though some people would say, how is the full moon ceremony ordinary, please? Well, it is, eventually. You do those same movements over and over again. Chant those same words. What used to be exotic gets closer and closer and closer until you can't really find it anymore outside of yourself, which is ideal. So I think we're gonna, because we have the council meeting, I think we're gonna do the short form, but we're gonna add, by special request, the precept recitation at the end. Okay, is that all right with everybody? Okay. Well, thank you very much. And as we've said, come and join in the study period any time that you want to or can. And all beings will benefit. Thank you very much.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit.